So welcome everybody to another episode in season two of the Real Life Sports Show with me, Sam Adams. And I'm really excited about today's guests. Please keep tuning in to season two because we've got some amazing guests coming up. I don't want to give away too much right now. I want to just focus on today's guest, who is the amazing and awesome hockey player, or England and Team GB hockey player, Tess Howard.
Thank
welcome.
You. Thanks for having me. Pleasure.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on board. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. Do you want to sort of do a little introduction to yourself? Who is Tess Howard? And yeah, that would be really cool if you wouldn't mind doing that.
Absolutely. Hello, Tess Howard. I am 23 years old. I have been in the Great Britain, England and England hockey team for the last 4 years. I have over 40 caps for England over that time and been lucky enough to play at the Europeans during the Pro League, which is a big tournament for hockey. And my hockey journey was quite different because, last year I was set to represent Team GB at the Olympics, but in April I ruptured my ACL. And so for the last 12 months, I wouldn't say I was a hockey player. I was more of a gymmer. And I've been recovering for the last 12 months, but very happy to say that last week I had my first game back and it went very well against Germany. So I'm back.
You're back officially a hockey player again.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. We've never had a hockey player on, which is great. So you are the first. Tell me a little bit about, I'd love to know a little bit. I always ask my guests about their early years, I guess, in terms of sport. I'm a huge sports fan. You know, it was kind of, I wasn't academically bright at school, but I was good at most sports. So it's just a saving grace for me. It got me through school. I'm pretty sure it got me friendships and things like that. And it basically saved my life because I had a little bit going on as a kid, and it really was my saving grace as a kid. So, and most people I have on this show, it starts pretty early on. So I'm interested to know what your journey is to get into hockey, and did that start at a young age?
Yeah, well, you talk about saving grace. Well, rugby was my first saving grace. I have an older brother and a younger one as well, but I used to follow my older brother to rugby training and just get stuck in. When I was growing up, I was very, very sporty and didn't really understand why a lot of my friends who were girls didn't want to play sport. And so I would just follow my brother and follow my friends at school who were boys to play. And so it started off with rugby, and my rugby coach from age sort of 10 always used to tell my dad, "No, she's gonna play rugby for England." But unfortunately, girls couldn't play rugby when I turned 11. I couldn't be the only girl in the boys team. I mean, you could have a girls team, but there weren't enough girls. So that effectively ended my rugby career at age 11. And my mum said, "Oh, why don't you just swap in hockey for rugby?" So I went along to Cambridge City Hockey Club and fell in love with the technical and the team and the tactical aspects of it all. Like, for me, it had everything, you know, and there were very few rules. I mean, there are a lot of rules in hockey, but in my opinion, it was a sport you could be free in. You could provide that ultimate pass to your teammate to score, or you could be the one to score, or you could do a defense that helps the team. You could do everything. And I loved having a purpose. And I think when I look back at my childhood, my happiest memories are, you know, maybe on the team bus on the way back from a game, or you know, all of my memories seem to have sport in there. And I was lucky. Like, I went to a very good school, and academics has always been a very big part of who I am. But the outlet for me to be able to express myself has always been on the hockey pitch.
Yeah, that's interesting, really interesting. And I love that bit you said about the bus.
Yeah.
Because I remember those days as a kid as well. I did athletics and things like that. And it is that camaraderie, isn't it, that you get from playing team sports, where you make those real bonds, is on the bus as much as anything. It's in on the training pitch, not so necessarily what happens in actual game day or, you know, competition day, but outside of that, because that's the majority of it, right? The, you know, game day is just that small little bit of it.
Absolutely. And if I reflect on the last 16 months, I only trained because I had, you know, this injury to overcome, and I had to just put into a box the idea of playing matches. And I first had to focus on playing, and it was very isolating for me because it was, I loved team sport, and that's the whole reason why I play a team sport, and why I honestly think the only reason why I'm a professional hockey player now is because I love being part of a team, and I love chasing those moments with the team. So if I look back on my childhood, my best friends have always come from those, the moments where you win or you lose and you're always together. That's very special.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you talk about rugby. You touched on rugby being your first sort of sport that you loved, and you know, the rise in women's rugby. We've just had the Six Nations, which I've really enjoyed. My brother is a big rugby fan. He's got three sons. They all play rugby. And I've never really been drawn into it, but this year I've really got drawn into it with the Six Nations. And because of my work, I work with some athletes. And I'm obviously a big fan of promoting women's sport and getting us more visibility and changing the narrative. And so I've been a lot more aware of women's rugby probably in the last 18 months, I guess. Do you think, like, if it had been, the opportunities have been there now, would you rather watch hockey? Like, now you probably could do both, maybe.
Well, my school didn't really do rugby for girls, so it would have, the winter sport was hockey. So I would have found both. I am so pleased that I found hockey because of the freedom. I think, you know, in rugby, you still have your set position, and it's quite niche which position you play. And so in that respect, I love hockey because I can be defending on the last man, you know, on the goal line, or I can be the first man right at the top. And that's why I love it. That's why I encourage everybody to play it, because I mean, I love what rugby is doing, saying that it's just, rugby is for everybody, every type of body as well.
Yeah.
I love that. And I think that's had a huge uptake in a lot of women and girls. But hockey is exactly the same. Like, you can be of any body type and play of any age. I mean, last week I saw the over 80s playing England versus Holland at Bisham Abbey. And they were, it's essentially walking hockey, but you know, they one pass and it gets to everybody and then they score. It's just brilliant. So
amazing.
Well, when I was at Cambridge City, I played with this guy called Olympic Dave. We would play summer hockey together, and he had been to the Seoul Olympics in 88, where GB had won gold. And he was the hero of the club. And I was playing summer hockey with him at age like 14. So, you know, that's what I love about hockey as well. And that you can play with men and women. I mean, you can also do that in rugby, but it's slightly more different.
The physicality, I guess,
different. But in hockey, all you need is good stick skills and and decent legs, and then you can compete with whoever. But yeah, maybe in another lifetime I was a rugby player, who knows. It's cool because they train at Bisham Abbey as well in the gym, so I see some of them.
Oh, cool. Do you excel at any other sports? Was there any other sports you got into? Because I'm interested to know if you've just got this all-round natural sporting ability, or was it maybe just these two sports, these two areas?
No, I always played every sport I could at school. I was very good at tennis at a young age, and really enjoyed it playing doubles. I enjoyed less so singles because of, for some reason, I just think it's a mental battle, and I preferred, you know, expressing myself with other people rather than just going very inwards. But yeah, I loved you know, cricket as well at school, and rounders and netball. You know, I joke because I loved netball, but then I didn't understand why you had to stay in only a third.
Yeah.
When you were a goal defence.
Yeah, it's a bit frustrating.
So then I thought, do you know what? I'm not for this restriction life. And if anybody knows me, they can say I don't do well with restrictions.
No, I used to find that frustrating in netball as well. I'm totally with you on that one. I loved rounders as well as a kid. That was so much fun. I mean, obviously, you know, you like to say you've had 40 caps now. You know, you play in the pro. It's a professional league, right?
Yeah, so the pro league is just the top 10 teams in the world play against each other, sort of, you know, back-to-back games. It's changed. The format has changed a little bit, but the idea is to get hockey throughout the whole year rather than just concentrating it in one tournament. So we've just been to the US and to Germany to play some pro league games. We went to Argentina earlier this year. So it's really, they call it bringing hockey home. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just it's not concentrated in one, you know, one location, but it's spreading out the best teams in the world.
Right. And I mean, how does that work out for you? So there's only 10 teams in that league. Is it just played in the winter? People maybe listen to this and don't understand it totally. And I don't understand it. So I think obviously knowledge is power. And, you know, the more we know about it, the more we want to be involved in it, right?
Absolutely. Hockey is an all-round the year sport. Traditionally, the domestic leagues, so that's like your Premier League, your national leagues, like just like in football, we have the Premier League. And though that's played from September through to April, and we have playoffs at the end of the year. So those are the domestic club teams. The international scene is a little bit different because all of our international tournaments normally happen in the summer. So this year we have the World Cup and the Commonwealth Games. And the Pro League was introduced to create hockey matches throughout the year. So now it's throughout the year, every month you might have every sort of 6 weeks, you might have a couple of matches to get to. Could be India, it could be New Zealand or Australia or Argentina or the US, and it creates these spectacles and for the fans to watch as well. So it's just regular hockey. So yeah, the top 10 teams for both men and women. It's one of the beautiful things about hockey is that every tournament is the same for men and women. So the Pro League is both men and women. And you have a running leaderboard throughout the whole thing. So it's essentially like being in a Premier League for international teams, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And there's a big trophy and playoffs at the end of the year as well. So it just creates more, more do or die matches throughout the year, which is cool.
And that's been going quite a while, hasn't it, that league, as far as I'm aware?
Yeah, when I joined in 2018, it was the beginning of the Pro League. So it used to be one game per country, which was ridiculous because you would fly to New Zealand and play one game and then fly to Australia. Yeah. So then we realized the carbon footprint of that is absolutely horrendous. So it's now gone to two games. And actually next year it's going to three games with three different teams. So it's like a mini tournament. So they're trying their best to work out what's the best way to have this structure, because we just want more matches and more hype around hockey. Yeah. So that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and you know, it's changing the format, isn't it, in order to create that excitement and bring more spectators in. And you know, it's like cricket. Like, I've never been a fan of cricket except when I'm in the Caribbean. I love watching it when I'm in the Caribbean. I'll go sit there all day and watch cricket. It's so long. And, you know, I like the one day T20 kind of stuff. Like, I go there in the evening, late afternoon in the summer, and it's really quick and exciting and it's all done and dusted. But it creates the hype and it creates the excitement. And I think the relatively, you know, lesser sports, that's what they need to be doing, in my opinion, is you need to create these formats that are going to bring in the crowds, that are going to get excitement. And they're all evolving, right? You know, we look at, like I say, rugby's changed a lot, cricket is changing a lot. It's how can we create more of a buzz around it that will want people to play it more, and also that the spectators will want to watch it as well. So it sounds like some of that is going on in the hockey world.
Yeah, and we have Lee Valley, which is the Olympic Park hockey stadium, and we have at the end of May, early June, we have four back-to-back matches per weekend, and that's going to bring so much energy because you'll have four weekends of hockey on TV and at Lee Valley. So, you know, hopefully we'll hook people you know, in a couple of weeks when we play China, and then we play Spain, and then we play Holland, and then we play Belgium, and it's hopefully just bringing more of an energy. And what we're trying to do is connect sports fans, not just hockey fans, to the game. So that's where we're trying to, what we're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so important, isn't it? We've seen that, like I say, with rugby. I think just generally sports fans coming in, like I've become a fan of rugby, like I said, whereas before I wasn't. I'm a general sports fan, but it wasn't something I went out of my way to watch, but actually now I will. So it's correct, you know, I've become a fan of rugby, and of course, yeah, we want to do that with hockey as well, and all of these sports. So tell me a little bit what it's like for you. How does your life look? And I know you've only just gone back into the pro league and stuff like that because of your injury, but what is your day-to-day life like? Because I think that's a lot of people like to try and understand what it takes. What's your daily life like when you are playing professional sport and you know you play at an elite level?
Yeah, so very lucky that the GB hockey team is supported by the National Lottery and UK Sports. So we are essentially full-time athletes. We train four times a week at Bisham Abbey National Sports Centre. So a typical week for me is Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday training. You will have a hockey session with the team in the morning or the afternoon, and equivalent gym session morning or afternoon, depending on what the day plan is. It's very, what we call it, centralised when we are in Bisham, and normally we'd have sort of 3 weeks centralized and 1 week decentralized, because we're very lucky that hockey is aware of the need for the balance in life. So when we don't have matches scheduled, then it's important for us to get some rest time. So a day to day, you know, we're diligent with our, you know, nutrition, with our you know, every day we have to make sure that our bodies are ticking in the right direction for elite sport. And hockey is a incredibly intense sport. If you think of football, it's identical in terms of the game, except obviously we use a stick and there's no offside rule. So you can run and run and run wherever you like. And there are rolling substitutes. So you can run and run and run, and then you can get subbed off. And then you, so you have a team of 16 and only 11 play at one time. So it's like, yeah, it's incredibly intense from a running perspective. And then you've got the technical, tactical aspects to it as well. All trying to put that little ball in the goal. anyway, yeah, so a lot of our training is conditioning and strength, because, you know, not only do you have to be able to run extremely fast and have good endurance, but you have to have the power, you know, to be able to, you know, move the ball at incredible speeds and, take the impact of a lot of what happens on a hockey pitch. My specialty is what I call floor work. So being able to I actually did judo when I was younger as well, so I'm very comfortable being on the floor in terms of shooting, and I scored last weekend in the Germany matches on the floor as well, diving. So you know, you're talking about the margins for to get your body into the best possible condition, but then also all of those team meetings around tactics and technical areas. So it's very intense, but they do give us rest as well.
So when you say you have 3 weeks centralized and 1 week decentralized, is that a week off then, are you saying? Is that what decentralized week is?
Yeah, It's sort of, you know, training. You're still training, but you're training away from Bisham. So it's important for us to get that mental break and to reset. So this week is decentralized for us, but you know, we're going back into 3 weeks of centralized training and matches every weekend against the opposition I mentioned. So we have to be in a place where we mentally can go very, very hard the next 3 weeks. So half of your week's probably, the first half's recovering and the second half's preparing.
Yeah, I can imagine. I used to do shifts, and that's like, you know, when you get your day off, the first day isn't your day off because you're just recovering from doing night shifts and stuff. So yeah, I can totally get that. It's really interesting, actually, that you have that system in hockey. I wasn't aware that it was to that level, actually, that you have that level of support. So I'm assuming that in camp, as it were, you have all of the support that you need, from a physical to keep your nutrition right, your physicality. Obviously, you've had an injury, so I'm assuming that you know your ACL, you got a huge amount of support with that, in terms of trying to rehab you back as quickly as possible. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. So we are fortunate to have the English Institute of Sport to help GB and England hockey as sort of one body. And when I did my ACL, I was, you know, absolutely distraught, but they sort of rationalized everything for me. They sort of broke it all down, and I was lucky to have essentially almost like a full-time physio and strength and conditioning coach to help me through the whole period. In a way, it becomes your own little team. So, you know, I talk of Jen and Roy, they're my physio and S&C, and they became my family. So, you know, it's things from the ability to get in touch with a surgeon of the highest quality in the country to perform the operation, and had to have the care post operation, to my physio calling me, you know, the day after to help me with my first exercises. And you know, they lent me an ice machine. I mean, I speak to a lot of young people now to help them through their ACL injuries, and I struggle sometimes to explain to them sort of what my experience was like, because, you know, I was going through a lot of grief and pain, and it was horrible, but at least I had, you know, the support, the best support I could get. And so I feel very, very grateful that England hockey sort of, you know, keep backing me and keep looking after me. And, you know, everybody who goes through an injury in our team has the very best care. And in that way, it's sort of really, really humbled me over the last year. The small things like the physio being able to massage your scars, you know, they know exactly what to do. Or I made a joke with my physio, because it was sort of like maybe a month and a half in, and she's like, right, we're gonna start doing some hamstring exercises, because they take a hamstring graft for your to reconstruct your ACL ligament. And I said, how do you know that, you know, week eight I have to be doing this? I said, it's like an ACL handbook or something. She's like, Tess, it's not an ACL handbook, it's 5 years of experience with ACL. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's no handbook to it. They're just that good. And they wanted me to come back, you know, even better than I left. And I for a long time I thought that was sort of I felt quite kind of daunted by the idea of coming back better. But, you know, something simple as, you know, strength of upper body, I have become obsessed with. I love it now. And it shows on the hockey pitch how much I've improved simply through the rehab and the diligence in the gym.
Brilliant. That is incredible. Incredible that you've got that support, because I know there's so many other sports that just don't get that level. So it's you know, I believe all sports should have that level. You know, if you're playing professionally in an elite level, it should be there, right? But sadly it isn't. I mean, how I've spoke to many people before about injuries, and obviously some can be career changing or career ending, sadly, for you, obviously, that's not been the case, but I'm sure there was a psychological impact to that, you know, because all sports people, like, I'm no elite athlete. I ran at county level. That was the highest level I got, but I loved it. I just wanted to play sport. I just wanted to do sport. I still do. I still play tennis. I still run. I just want to participate. How was that for you, not being able to participate?
It was the hardest thing that I've ever had to go through. It's been the biggest challenge that I think I've faced in my life so far, because the layers of grief were very complicated. At the start, I was very, very confused about why it happened, because ACL injuries are very, I'd say, fluky. Like, you don't really know that they're going to happen. So I was just playing at training and accelerated. I didn't even really change direction, and it just went. So in that respect, I sort of replayed the injury over and over again, wondering why I did this, why I did that. And that's very, very unhelpful to any mind. So the layers of grief, that's what I struggled most with, the physical injury, but then also missing the Olympics, and knowing I was so close, and also then to watch my team win a bronze medal and not being able to compete in the sport that I love for 12 months, knowing that it would be 12 months. Like, it's they said, you know, it's people get back at 7 months, people get back at 8 months, but then their likelihood of re-injury is so high. They said to me, for every month that you delay your return from, you know, from seven, you reduce your risk of injury by 50%. So if you keep adding the months, then your risk of re-tear is so low. And I said to them, look, I only want to do this rehab once. So I'm going to do it. And if it takes me 3 months more, it takes me 3 months more, but I'm not going to go back half-hearted. And I also said to them, I'm going to be on the floor as soon as I get back. So this knee has to be, has to be strong. But I was also very fortunate to have psychological help. We have a psychologist for the team, and I also sought extra help out because I knew that, you know, the injury part, I could turn up to the gym and I could do it every day. Like, I could do that, but, you know, I could do that from a physical perspective, but could I do that mentally? You know, I realized, well, at the time I realized how hard it was, and what it takes. And now looking back, I realized how much resilience I had to dig. And I, sometimes I look back and I think, how did I do that for 12 months? I don't know. I actually don't know. I was almost like in some sort of trance, just going through it, just saying, you know, one day closer. But it all was worth it, because last week when I played against Germany, and, you know, it was very lucky that a friend of my teammate passed me this beautiful pass into the into the D, and all I had to do was do what I had done for months and just slot the ball in the goal. And then it was like, wow, my wildest dreams have come true. I'm finally back on the pitch and contributing to the team. So, you know, in that respect, like, now if I ever have an injury again, I know that I can get through it.
It's often, you know, an area that gets missed or left, you know, for, you know, not, you know, obviously I'm a life coach, and I work with athletes and high performers, and, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but, you know, we all have stuff going on in our minds. Without our minds, we are nothing. And so, you know, learning to be in control of what state we're in is absolutely crucial to, you know, how we perform on the pitch and how, what life is like day in, day out. But there are obviously some sports and professional sports where they don't get a lot of, you know, sports psychology or a psychologist at all. And but we all, it doesn't matter which human you are, whether you're playing sport or not, actually, you know, we all need some kind of support, especially the world that we live in today, the kind of world that we live in, what we all see in social media and how that's all put out to the world and how that's all fed back. We all need that kind of, I believe that we all need some kind of coach or support you know, I have a coach, you know, as a coach, I have a coach, you know, I can't see everything for myself. It's just impossible. None of us can. And we need that redirection sometimes. We need that someone to help us see a different perspective, but especially crucial when actually, yeah, you're grieving for the loss of not being able to do the one thing that you love and you get paid to do. It can be, you know, I've spoken to, you know, some athletes that have had career ending injuries, and the impact has been absolutely devastating in more than one area of their life. So yeah, it's a crucial area. So I'm really pleased you've got support.
Yeah. I also think that what you mentioned there about different areas of your life can be affected through injury, that's something I really experienced, because I was in my final year of my Durham University degree, geography degree, and you know, I thought it would be my escape, and I thought I would have time to really go in deeper into the topics that I really enjoy. But in sort of September time, at around sort of like 6 months through my injury, I hit a wall, and I had no energy other than to do my rehab exercises and do my gym work. I could not face doing anything else. I sort of retracted myself from social engagements, and I stopped doing all of my university studies, and I was scaring myself, because I thought, how do I have no enthusiasm for the things that I love? Yeah. And it took me a good couple of months and a trip to Wales with my family to really unpick everything that was going on. And it was that next layer of grief, which, you know, grief has several stages, and it was the stage of depression that I was not expecting. I thought I had been through that. I thought I was sad, but it is actually a much deeper thing that you go through. But you have to go through it in order to get to acceptance, which is where I got to sort of beginning of this year. And I vowed to myself that this year I would look after myself from a health perspective and let everything else fall into place elsewhere. And suddenly I was, you know, back to my old ways, you know, loving my degree and loving training and seeing positives everywhere. But, you know, it takes a toll on you mentally, and you have to give yourself that time to grieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, obviously I deal with the mental side rather than the physical side of life, and for all of us. And it's sadly oftentimes for all of us, not just in sport, but, you know, or with high performers, you know, it's the thing that gets left to last, when, you know, obviously in my world, it's the thing that should be prioritized, because everything stems from there. You know, if you feel if you experience happiness or suffering, that's a state of mind. That's not about, you know, what's going on out there, which is how most people think. And it takes some doing to think, to understand it and to think differently and to change your perspective. But it does all start in the mind. Everything starts in the mind. And, you know, if you can learn to live in peace, which is an inner state that we can control, and you do that work on yourself and on your mind and understanding yourself, and like you said, having that self-acceptance, taking responsibility, that actually improves your performance. It will improve your potential. And that's the bit that I'm really big on, that getting more people to understand that. And, you know, sadly, a lot of professional sports won't pay for someone like me. They'll pay for a sports psychologist, but not me. So I get individual athletes who will come and go, you know, actually, I want to do this extra work for me, and I'm going to fund it out of my own pocket, because I just realize I need to speak to somebody on a regular basis, that which is not about my coach's opinion, that they have nothing to do with that. It's completely independent, because they recognize that actually I need this well-rounded person in here and in here. And that is actually going to elevate me out there. That's going to elevate my performance on the pitch and stuff like that. So, and it sounds like, you know, from what you've just said, that you've at a young age, by the way, because you're only 23, you've really got a good grasp of that already. So keep preaching that message.
Well, because as I joined the team when I was 19, and it was in a period of huge volatility, we had lost our head coach, and we were sort of all trying to perform well when the team's, if you think about a team's mental state, it was all over the place. And so very quickly, like I was only one of my sort of age group and friendship group that sort of made it into the team that young. And I was trying to become friends with people I didn't know, teammates, first of all, teammates and then friends. And I knew that if I was going to survive in this environment of intense pressure and high challenge, then I had to sort of look after myself, but also like try and make connections with people. So, but then I think it's only really this last year that I've really reflected on the, you know, I do think there are elements of psychological trauma throughout a in elite sport. And I think I had forgotten the highs and lows of sport as I experienced last week against Germany. We played amazing in the first game, won, didn't play very well on the second game, and we lost. And you know, it went from we're the best team in the world to oh my god, what are we doing? And I forgot how draining it is and how drained I had been over the years that we weren't performing particularly well, but we were still, you know, it was so roller coaster of emotions. And I knew if I wanted to succeed and play a consistent role for the team, then I would have to learn to have consistent emotions throughout. But, you know, I'm still learning about it. I mean, it took me a couple of days to recover from the defeat because I forgot what it's like to lose. I hadn't lost. I mean, I had lost in different ways, but I hadn't actually lost a game.
Yeah.
You know, in 16 months. So I had to work out what to do with my brain. And the only thing I knew what to do was to go back to my work, because that's just the solid that I have. So that's how I sort of maintain level.
Yeah, and then I think that's important for, you know, athletes and for all of us, that, you know, is to have outside interests. I was talking to a footballer the other day, and, you know, an elite footballer plays at the highest level, but he does have outside interests. And we were talking about that and how good that's been for him and his mental well-being. Whereas obviously I know in some areas, you know, coaches and managers want you just to focus on nothing but your sport and are not too supportive of outside interests. But I, you know, I'm a massive believer that can enhance your performance. You know, we're all multifaceted, right? We've all got different interests. And yes, you might play this to an elite level, but you have other interests, whether that's academia or whatever it might be. And it's important that we fill all of these cups, right? That we get some kind of, you know, because it will give us all energy and it will support our well-being and our foundation of who we are. And we need that foundation and rock solid so that, yes, when we're in the pressure environment of elite sport and you win or you lose, that you manage the tidal waves that come and to ride it out. So those other areas of your life are really super important. And that's where it's really important to really understand who you are all round. You're not just a hockey player. And I see it a lot in football, especially men's football, that, you know, they're just seen as a footballer, they're seen as a commodity, and it's very difficult for this identity outside of football, which is super important to that foundation and their stability and their mental well-being. But I mean, that's something I probably could talk about all day long, but I'm very conscious of time and I want to get to a couple of other bits, because you know, you've got a, you know, you were Durham's Sportswoman of the Year or Sportsperson of the Year. You've had this injury, didn't go to Tokyo. So you've had a lot happen, you know, and, you know, like you say, 19 when you joined the team, you know, you've got this amazing career already. But I know that there's another side to you in terms of, you know, when we look at women's sport and what's happening around that. And I saw your LinkedIn yesterday and talking about the kits for women. Do you want to talk about just some of that aspect to sport around women, your feelings around some of what's going on and what you hope for the future around it?
With pleasure. Thank you. Yeah, so for context, yesterday a friend of mine wrote an article about the match kits that GB women's hockey team play in, which is on Adidas's website. It's called a tank compression top, which probably highlights kind of how we feel about it right now, because I don't think tank compression is the correct item for us to be playing an elite sport in. Anyway, My experience with understanding sort of my role in women's sport really started from a point of academics. So in my second year, I had to choose my dissertation topic. And for some reason, I kept coming back to this idea of why do we have to wear gendered uniforms in hockey in schools and in a lot of other sports like hockey and tennis and netball. And it kept coming back and I kept seeing it everywhere. I saw it once and then I saw it in, you know, in school, actual school uniforms, and I saw it in business attire. And I just kept coming back to this why. And people who know me know I just love to ask why. So I kept going and realized that my dissertation had to be on this. I had to, because there wasn't enough for me out there to understand. So my dissertation was called Practical, Professional or Patriarchal. And it was an investigation into school sports uniform and the gendered aspect of them and the impact of that on girls' sporting experiences at school. So I thought I would choose schools because you know, it's an obvious institution. It's obvious that there are policies in place, there are rules, there are regulations, and it was a very easy way to show that institutionally there is gender discrimination. So I looked at the government's policies on school uniform, and it said schools can decide if girls can wear trousers. So that's still in the policy, that the school's choice, not the girl's choice. So I kept coming back to this idea of why does there have to be so much disciplinary power over girls' bodies? And, you know, you've seen it just, you know, recently in the US, they're overturning Roe v. Wade in terms of abortion, and this constant control over women's bodies. And for me, the first line, the thing that I can do is combat that in women's sport. So through my dissertation, which very fortunate that it was awarded the best geography dissertation in Durham, and it gained quite a lot of traction. And I wrote an article last year for The Telegraph on hyper-feminized and impractical uniforms, because I found that 75% of the 400 women I surveyed said that they saw girls drop out of sports at school purely because of body image or sports kit issues. So, you know, it's a huge issue. In my opinion, it's the most underrated reason why girls drop out of sport, because they say it's body image, but or they say it's I don't feel comfortable. But you have to go back to what actually is making you uncomfortable. And a lot of the time it's too tight, it's too this, it's too that, it's not what people want to be in. So I became ardently passionate about women's sports kit, and for the last couple of years I have been sort of campaigning in my own little way to raise consciousness to this. And in 2020, when the pandemic hit, I had just joined the Unlocked Women's Sports Trust program, and so there you get partnered with a mentor and you get a whole, you get access to a whole bunch of other incredible people like Sue Anstis and Victoria Rush, who just did No Woman No Try. And I finally realized that my calling was not just to be a hockey player, but to help create momentum and change around school sport uniform, around sports wear. And, you know, following the Olympics in 2021, where you saw, you know, the Germans wear full leotards, you know, the conversation was building momentum. We had Holly Bradshaw, the pole vaulter. She was demanding Adidas for her own kit that didn't have to be a bikini. And you had the volleyball players playing in shorts for the first time, and obviously Pink offering to pay their legal settlement, which is fantastic. Yeah, brilliant.
Love that.
So all of this was like happening, and I was like, oh my word, I need to do my part. And unfortunately, like, change happens very slowly, and that sort of hit me quite hard when I went to my performance director last year and said, can we talk about the women's kit, because everybody feels uncomfortable. They said there's no real proof and we don't have the budget really. So then I partnered with a friend of mine in the team who also felt quite strongly about kit, and we sent out a survey about a couple of months ago asking our teammates, what do you feel or when you wear the kit, and overwhelmingly people felt uncomfortable, felt like they were on show, that it was not helping their performance. And actually 60% said that if they had improved kit, that their self-confidence and performance would improve. So, you know, now it's a performance margin. It's not just, you know, talking about gender segregation. It's not talking about that. It's now performance. And really what it is saying, why can women not belong in sport? Because, you know, first of all, you have to belong in yourself. And that's a huge part of what kit does, belonging to your team, making you feel proud to be on the pitch. So an hour later, that is my contribution.
Well, we probably get something we could talk about probably for a long time, I think, because there's a lot going on. And you mentioned Victoria and Sue Anstis as well. They're both coming on this season of the podcast, which I'm really delighted. Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah, so you're going to be in good company.
Legends.
Yeah, both legends. So, yes, you're going to be in good company for season two. And I'm sure we'll, you know, no doubt talk about more of this kind of thing with those two as well. But yeah, it's 60%. I mean, wow, I wrote that down. 60% of your teammates, that's incredible. I'm not surprised. And there definitely needs to be change. And like you said, sadly, change does take a painfully freaking slow amount of time to happen. But it, you know, in my opinion, it needs to happen quickly. And I know for me, just growing up, you know, I didn't see myself, you know, in a lot of the worlds that I wanted to be in. And I was always a tomboy. You know, I didn't want to be wearing dresses and skirts anyway, let alone, like, I did athletics. So I was basically in a bikini like Holly, you know, like, I hated it, you know, and I competed. Like I say, I was, a county level. I was a good county athlete, but, you know, I was in a bikini. I freaking hated it, you know. So yeah, it makes you think now, look, thinking back, I'm thinking how, you know, if I'd been more comfortable, and I definitely wasn't comfortable in my own skin back then, what difference it would make, you know, to me and to all of the other athletes and people that play sport at whatever level. You have to feel comfortable in your own skin, and you have to feel comfortable in, you know, what you put on your body, and that's your choice at the end of the day. And this is the message that needs to be out there, that it's a choice that each athlete can make, rather than it's placed upon us. So it is probably something I could talk about a lot. Oh gosh, I've kept you way longer than I said I would.
No, it's a pleasure.
No, it's really good. And I'd love to talk loads about this. I think, you know, we need to be out there having more of these conversations and creating change and seminars and summits and workshops and a whole bunch.
All coming, all in time. Yeah. Watch this space.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, let me know. But before you go, I would really just, I guess, what are your hopes for the future in terms of, you know, where hockey's heading, and also for your career? How would you like it to play out, I guess?
It's a good question, because I've been sort of stuck in this one place, which is I just want to play again. So, you know, tick on the playing again. But my hopes is that I sort of keep loving the game and keep progressing through my own hockey. I have huge aspirations of where I think my team can go. I want to help England get back to the top of hockey. And you know, whatever part I can play in that, I will be happy with. I want to, you know, go out and play in Holland one day, and which is, you know, almost like the Premier League here. I guess it's funny, because my idea of being a professional hockey player, it was never really my plan. So I'm just sort of riding the wave of you know, joy, being able to fly around the world playing the game I love. But, you know, I want my career to have more meaning than that, and that's why I feel very passionately about social environmental change within the sporting community. And if I can do that, and let's say my career only lasts another 4 years, then at least I know I've done what I can. But if what I'd like it to do is last another 10 years, and for me to go to several So that's what I would love. But ultimately, it's about enjoying the game and being the best I can be for my team to help us get back that number one spot.
Well, I look forward to watching you do it. So this year, there's the Euros and the Commonwealth Games are on.
Yeah, we have the World Cup 1st of July and the Commonwealth Games is August.
Yeah. So that's something to look forward to. Any fans listening or anyone that's not involved in hockey, I think we need to all go and check out.
Commonwealth Games is in Birmingham.
I know.
So it's home turf.
Yeah, home turf. I'm going to be doing my best to get to as much of that as possible. I'd love to be there every day, to be quite frank. I was supposed to be in Tokyo as well. So when the whole pandemic, I was supposed to be in Tokyo for the whole month. I was gutted to get there. I'm sure it was harder for you than it probably was for me, but I'm still gutted about my trip and seeing a lot of sport in a month. But I do intend on being in Birmingham. So you never know, we might run into each other, and I hope our paths do cross and we can sit down over a coffee or whatever and have maybe a further chat about the future of women's sports and a whole load of other things. But I see you, there's a guy called Les Brown. He's a motivational speaker. He's a good friend of mine. He has been known as the world's number one motivational speaker. And he always, he's got many quotes that roll off of his tongue. And he always says, you know, Sam, you've got to distract, dispute and inspire. And I feel like you're a bit of a distractor and a disputer and an inspirer. And that's kind of where I see going, because that came into my head when you were talking quite passionately about your future and what you want to do. So I hope I think you're already, you know, inspiring and distracting and creating waves, which is amazing, because none of us really, we're not here to be mediocre and average, right? And I don't think you are. So it's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation. I feel like I'd probably talk to you for another hour, but I will let you go. Thank you so much, Tess, for being on the podcast. It's been a real joy to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
No worries.